10% increase in average minimum price was associated with a 32%
percent
reduction in alcohol attributable deaths.
So again, it's still misuse.
Yeah. And significant reductions in chronic and total alcohol attributable deaths were detected between 2 and 3 years after minimum price increases. And this,
Yeah. 3 years,
that takes a while.
Well, but, and it usually does take time to see the impact, yeah. Right? Hello and welcome to Do You Even Science, a podcast where we discuss what's happening in Canadian science and policy and everything in between. We're your hosts. I'm Dina Hamza, and with me is Simon Landry. Hey, Simon.
Hey, Dina. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. So last week we talked about using titles, whether it's Dr. Dina Hamza, Dr. Simon Landry, and what did we decide? How am I supposed to refer to you?
Dr. Dina Hamza.
Doctor, the whole thing.
I've earned it, Simon. I am an expert. I have earned it. But you know, the root of this discussion was that hashtag immodest women. It was where women were referred to in articles as Miss or Ms. rather than doctor. And these were PhD holders.
Yes. And I have to apologize, Dina, because last week or 2 weeks ago, I did make fun of you for choosing a hashtag for a topic, and I thought it would be completely passé, completely out of the news cycle, but I think last week it came back in.
Yeah, I think this is something, a topic that will continue to be discussed. I think there will be this ebb and flow of the topic, but it will continue to exist.
And
so you had actually sent out, I don't recall the specific role.
She's no longer the chief scientist.
For Ontario. For Ontario. That's what I thought.
And it's really funny because we can't look into the future, but somehow we had an episode on referring to PhD holders as doctor in the news last week. And then this week we were going to have this episode on Ontario's sort of policies and the health related policies.
Yeah.
And so between recording the last episode and recording this one, the Ontario government, the new Ontario government, fired their chief scientist.
And didn't refer to her as doctor.
And the Globe and Mail wrote about it and did not refer to her as Dr. Molly Choiquette.
Which is funny because I just saw a statement from the Globe and Mail a day ago. And I think I sent it to you where now PhD holders will be referred to as doctor in print, but those with honorary PhDs will not be referred to as doctor. I'm okay with that too.
I'm okay with that.
I don't know if they're okay with it, but I'm okay with it.
I mean, we have a non-honorary degree, so
that's right. It's
okay. And I don't want to say that Do You Even Science caused sort of this large publication to change their guidelines, but I'm pretty sure I think we played a significant part, even some might say. We will take all the credit, and if there are other organizations that kind of did stuff, we'll give you the leftovers.
But Ontario.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like almost every single day on my news feed, there's something about Ontario.
It's a hot place. It's a hot place. Lots of stuff going on.
I have a colleague who calls it the center of the universe.
Is that colleague from Ontario?
That colleague is from Ontario. So we would often have challenges coordinating times, just like you and I, Simon, to actually record or to do work together. And she would, instead of saying, 10 a.m. Eastern or Mountain Standard Time, she would send it as 10 a.m. center of the universe. Like, get it right, Dina. This is the center of the universe. Anywhere else doesn't matter.
Just figure it out based on
the me. Center of the universe.
Yeah. So to go back to the article for the Ontario's chief scientist, mm-hmm. now I'm wondering if she was the chief scientist. I feel like maybe there was a different title. But it was funny.
That was her title.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. It was funny. Well, not funny, but like when I saw that they didn't refer to her as Dr. Molly Choquette,
yeah.
I was like, hold up. Maybe it's just like a thing that they just do across the board. And so I found two other articles from the past, I think, 5 days. Because I was like, I want to give them, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt.
So just to be clear, Simon, mm-hmm. she is Ontario's first chief scientist. Oh,
chief scientist. Yes. Perfect.
So, yeah, I did see that. You actually posted a tweet. And it showed, I really liked how you presented that. It was side-by-side comparison, taking a look at all these other individuals who were male, who were referred to in the Globe and Mail with the title doctor, and they're PhD holders. Mm-hmm. And she was not referred to with the with the doctor title.
Did you also notice who wrote those articles?
A male.
So the male wrote Dr. Molly Choquette's article, but two women wrote the other articles where the men are referred to as
really?
Doctor.
Really? I know. I didn't pay attention to that. Uh-huh. I think you need to repost that, Simon, with that focus.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, so it was a policy, right? So let's say we had a policy, Globe and Mail, and that's what my understanding was. Mm-hmm. Globe and Mail had a policy that if you're a PhD holder, you wouldn't be referred to as doctor. It was only if you were an MD holder.
Yes.
So if that were true, that this is a well-known policy, I mean, I think that begs the question that is this a well-known policy? Apparently not.
I don't know. But also you got to wonder, and somebody in the tweets, you know, when we're researching last episode, pointed out that there's an editor who should be checking this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like it's literally their job to edit articles.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And they didn't catch on to it.
No. Mm. Strange.
Very.
Hopefully it'll change, and hopefully we won't need to talk about this for a while.
Well, we'll see, Simon.
We'll see.
So there are a couple of other interesting changes in Ontario. One mm-hmm. is specifically University of Toronto. They developed this policy within their university mandating medical leave for individuals with challenges associated with mental illness. And I think there have been various articles about this. On the one hand, it seemed to be coerced. The leave of absence, that it's coerced, that you would tell someone that from your perspective, you think that they're having these serious challenges with mental illness and therefore they would need to take a leave of absence. So then the question is what's the criteria and who's making that decision?
So someone could ask you to take a leave of absence because you're, I don't know, having mental health issues?
So it's not so much just having a mental... So when I read further, that was like the first article. It was like, uproar that there's, you know, U of T is mandating leave of absence for individuals with, you know, mental health concerns. It turns out that there's a process in which an individual may be going against code of conduct for the university, and it's tied to having challenges with mental illness. And rather than just having a consequence such as being suspended from the university, it will now be a leave of absence that's medical based. So I think on the one hand, that's a good thing. I think that's a good thing.
Okay.
It would be interesting to see if they're provided with appropriate resources. So you have this mandated leave of absence, but is that tied to actually seeking care?
Yeah. Could you, I'm having a tough time sort of visualizing where that would apply. Could you give me an example? It doesn't have to be based on facts, but what would be the context for somebody to use that leave of absence?
I think if someone is so it's based on the student's behavior. So if their behavior is, for example, aggressive or belligerent with a supervisor.
Okay.
And they're in the midst of something that's causing them extreme distress, rather than it just going to, here's this, you know, penalty or this idea of probation or suspension because of your behavior. They're now looking at it as a medical condition.
Okay.
And I think that's a good thing. From yes. my, from, you know, in my role as someone who is in the field of addiction and mental health, I think that's a good thing. I think the question will be, they're saying that they will actually review existing supports provided to the student, and okay. that the student would be offered voluntary leave.
Okay.
So there's an assessment process. It's not just, you know, hey, I think you're having some odd behaviors and therefore now you're going to have a leave of absence. But I think mm-hmm. the criteria, or like yeah. almost like the rubric that that somebody would have to go through in the department or in the faculty or in the university overall to then determine that this person needs a mandated medical leave of absence, I think that's where the transparency isn't the greatest. So I would okay. want to know, what is the criteria? The criteria is very vague. It's like, we're going to look at their existing supports. Did they have a voluntary leave of right. Absence before saying, okay, now there's this mandated leave?
Are you familiar with this policy? Like, do you know if it's, because it seems like a very responsive thing. Like something happened to someone and they were like, we need to take care of this giant loophole.
I think it's just mental health and addiction overall, right? So generally it's, you know, in my work with law enforcement, let's say, mm-hmm. in the past, it was if you were a belligerent person and you didn't comply with instructions, it's arrest you, put you in jail.
Right.
Now it's, okay, let me take a look at this situation. Is this person under the influence of a substance? And therefore, mm-hmm. that's causing these behaviors. Or is this person in the midst of a psychotic episode?
Right.
And that's why they're behaving in this way. That's different. So I think it's identifying that mental illness and substance use disorders are an illness.
Right.
It's not just, you know, you're just having these challenging behaviors and you're just a challenging person. And you're not mm-hmm. compliant. So I think on the greater, like the greater scope, mm-hmm. I think this could be a good thing. Again, it depends on how it's reviewed. Yeah. How a person's case is reviewed. And then not just saying, now you have this medical leave of absence. I think there has to be this continuum of care. So yeah. do they provide them with resources, or?
What is a continuum of care, Dina?
Oh, continuity of care, Simon. It's these connections from one care provider to the next.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, so it's the basis of a lot of my work. So, for example, it's like starting out in primary care mm-hmm. and then that connection to the specialist and the mm-hmm. connection perhaps to another specialist, but bringing that connection back to your primary care provider. So everyone's in the loop with your care. So you're not, there aren't lost opportunities for your care.
You know who I'd like to have on the show?
Who?
Huda. I forget her last name. I want to say it's Idris, but Huda Idris. She is the CEO of Dot Health, which is this platform where you have ownership over your medical records.
Oh, I've heard of something like that. I haven't heard of her or that particular platform, but I've heard of the concept.
I bet you have really interesting a really interesting perspective on the other side, like the more kind of businessy side of what you're describing.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's also great. So.
Well, and there's a lot of, I guess, I don't know if I would call them apps, but systems. Like there's things like mm-hmm. Easy Referral. Like there's these systems that are trying to be implemented in which you would be able to connect, like through a computerized pathway, that you'd be able to connect different specialists, different care providers. So not just physicians, but it would also be like the social worker, the dietitian, the psychologist. It's whoever you're working with. So you almost have this interdisciplinary team that is providing you with the best care that you need. It's not disjointed.
Right, right.
It's like this cohesion, this synergy of all these professionals working together to help you be the best you can be, wellness-wise.
And everyone, everyone has access to the same data.
That's the problem. That's the problem. Oh. So there are some in the electronic medical records, EMRs. Mm. So with mental health and substance use disorders, for example, often physicians don't have access to that information from, let's say, a specialist or a psychiatrist unless they're given permission. And it's essentially meant to protect the patient. Right. It's for the protection of the patient. So you don't have the patient's entire record available to anyone. Let's say the medical office assistant. And, you know, like it's to try and select who can see what. And that's the challenge. And it was originally the confidentiality and the disjointedness of, you know, who can seek what information specific to mental illness and substance use disorders. Originally, that was for the protection of the patient, but it's actually working against the patient.
That's funny.
Yeah.
How that kind of stuff happens.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's an area that we're working toward fixing.
Right. Do you remember there was a lot of talk a few years ago about, I want to say, police records being shared with, or maybe medical records being shared with the American government, and something like if there were suicide attempts or something, that would be in your medical record or your police record.
Oh.
And then that could lead to your border crossing, whatever the word is, being denied.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait, I think you're right, Simon. I think it had something to do with suicide.
Something like that. And then, I mean, there's the whole other can of worms that maybe we'll get to talk about later about when cannabis becomes legal.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So the other thing too, Simon, that I wanted to bring up. So that was the one thing. It's you and U of T. And again, we're just sharing how Ontario has been in the center of the universe.
Let's been just keep on in talking the spotlight.
Simon, you are one of them. So
no.
So yes, that's a policy with U of T. I think it can be a great thing, but again, we need to have transparency about the review process.
One last question. I'm just going to... So I have a close friend who, during her undergrad, went through a depression, a serious depression, and that impacted her grades negatively. And so she is kind of stuck with this burden of these grades.
Right.
And it's affected her, like, to this day. Now she's back at school, things are going great, but kind of she's unable to apply to certain grants and things because of that burden.
Yeah.
Would this policy address
count as a medical leave of absence. So, you know, when you apply for certain scholarships or funding opportunities, they will say, have you had a leave of absence?
Right.
This would be under that classification.
Okay.
And I think because it's mandated, there would be the appropriate documentation associated with it. Often with the leave of absence, though, I don't know if they, in my experience, in some of the criteria where they say, you know, examples of leave of absence, it's often if it's like a maternity leave. Or let's say you had to take a leave for like a physiological condition, such as you had to go have surgery or something along those lines, or you had a physical illness. It'll be interesting to see how they will react to, you know, challenges related to mental illness or substance use disorder. I think things are changing in that it's considered an illness, just like any other physiological illness.
Cool.
But like I said, it'll be interesting to see the review process, and it should be vetted by more than one person. I don't think that should be in the hand of one person.
Yeah.
The other policy type thing, I guess, or change, and this was a shocking one for me, Simon, is the PC government has decided to go back to the 90s, the late 90s.
The old Ford Nation marching back.
Yeah, back in the day, and teach the 1998 sexual education curriculum. And do you know what that means, Simon?
I listen. I went to school in the 90s, Dina.
So did I.
I feel like we both went to the school in the 90s. We came out fine-ish. What's the issue?
But things are different. Things are different, Simon. Things are different. I mean, back then, we had no knowledge. Like, they didn't teach us about same-sex relationships.
I my understanding is that homosexuality didn't exist in the 90s.
That's right. Right? Like it didn't exist.
It's a millennial thing.
So they didn't teach about same-sex relationships. They didn't teach anything related to the level of technology that we're at and social media. So things like sexting, cyberbullying, those sorts of concepts.
Yeah.
And so the point was that, you know, they're going back and they're going to revamp. My understanding is that they want to revamp the curriculum. It's not going to stay at this 1998 basis, but I think this is problematic. I think it's problematic to send or to provide this type of curriculum to youth in our society right now.
Yeah.
So for one, Simon, when you have a question about something, what's the first thing you do?
I look it up on the internet.
Exactly. So I think this type of decision that we're going to stay in this, you know, outdated sexual education curriculum is a lot of youth are going to resort to finding information on the internet. And that's not to say that they're not already doing that, but they don't have this triangulation of information that they're receiving from an educator in the school system. So I think there's going to be an increase in misinformation, an increase in unsafe practices. And I think that's challenging for youth. Youth have a lot of challenges as it is.
Yeah.
It's a challenging developmental stage.
It must be tough being a kid these days.
But do you know what's interesting, Simon, is some of the backlash related to this decision were from individuals who were removed from class. Do you remember that? Do you remember that when you were in school? I think the policy is still the same, that if your parents, I don't know if it's that it can it's considered consent if you don't sign and say, I don't want my child to be in the class. Is that how it works? Okay. Or do you have to sign to be in the class?
Like negative consent? Is that what you'd call it?
Well, it's that it's implied consent. So if you don't sign a paper saying, no, I don't want my child to participate, then that means that, yes, you are actually consenting.
Right.
But you're not actually providing, like, signed consent. It's implied consent.
And that's a thing that these kids aren't going to learn about, consent, with
absolutely. With the curriculum. Absolutely. I mean, with the new curriculum, it seems to be problematic. It seems to be a concept that's really challenging. So and imagine...
Yeah, it's just a challenging concept in the first place.
It like is. Yeah. So much of the backlash are from these individuals who actually had their parents sign and say, I don't want my child to participate in this sex education. And I read one story that was heartbreaking in that this individual thought what was happening to her from a family member, an older family member, was normal.
What?
So part of this sexual education is, as you said, consent, but also what is a healthy relationship? What is normal? Yeah. What is, you know, not so normal? And how to decipher between the two. So this individual was saying, I mean, I had this very negative experience. And this is because I didn't have appropriate sexual education.
Yeah. That it's like I haven't read the articles I feel as much as you have, but I'm aware that this curriculum thing is happening, and it's like someone will be hurt at
absolutely
several people, you know, like absolutely. If there's one person that's hurt and it's because these policies are put in place, it blows my mind that like we can't hold the adults that make that system happen accountable.
Yeah, it just blows my mind. It's that system level change. And then the question is, what is guiding these changes? And I think this really leads nicely into a topic that I know that you want to tell me about. And it ties into this evidence-based policy idea.
It does.
So
it does.
It's interesting to see that how, you know, there's a lot of evidence suggesting that a certain level of competence and knowledge and education can be preventative in negative outcomes related to, relationships, consent, or intimacy overall. Is mm-hmm. this change to the curriculum based on evidence?
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a bidirectional relationship, Simon, between evidence and policy, and I don't know if everyone is aware of this. It took me a long time to understand it. It's that evidence base mm-hmm. can then lead into policy development.
Right.
But
yes,
you can also implement a policy,
mm-hmm.
and then after that, seek evidence.
Right.
Of it working or not working, and then modify along the way.
Okay. That seems fair.
It can be, but I mean, if I put in a policy, for example, that we shouldn't be teaching this advanced or updated sexual education curriculum, but what's the evidence behind it? I think that there's going to be a period of time, considering mm-hmm. that we do have evidence suggesting otherwise. Maybe that's not the best example. Usually the implementation of a policy before an evidence base is that the evidence base isn't there yet. But we need some kind of regulation for a concept.
Yeah. Or it just feels right.
Like, how do we say feels right? To who?
So this is like, I've been thinking about this a fair bit, trying to make sense of this. And it seems like if it makes sense to someone who is voting for somebody,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that's all that matters. Mm-hmm. It's like, do you want to jump into the main topic?
I do. So this is Simon's topic today for our Do You Even Science episode. Buck a beer? Or the death of evidence-based policy. Oh, Simon, this buck a beer. Wow.
Love it.
Can you give us the rundown? Like, give us the synopsis for those of us who aren't familiar with Doug Ford. So this was prior to him winning the election.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This was one of his things to draw people in that he's going to do this buck a beer policy. Yeah.
So it's, I'll set the stage. It's May 2018. It's a beautiful day in Ontario, of course. I actually remember this because I was walking with my partner and I was on Twitter because I always am on Twitter. It's a bit problematic. And I saw this tweet by Doug Ford, and it mm-hmm. was like, Ford voters, guess what? Buck a beer is back. No more paying the big bucks, fattening the pockets of the fat cats over in Labatt or whatever. And so his thing was like, if I'm elected, this is before the elections, if I'm elected, we're going to lower the minimum price of beer to a buck.
So my understanding for one, Simon, is that he was like, we're going to put people first before the government by this buck of beer policy. And the buck of beer was reducing, as you said, the cost to a dollar. What was the cost prior?
I think like $1.20.
Oh, so it was like, it's a 20 cent difference?
yeah.
Oh.
But it's not, because I think you could buy a 24 pack for like $26 or something like that.
So now you can purchase it for $24.
$24 plus deposit.
Wow.
I
don't really know what to say to that, Simon.
Yeah. Well, it's so silly.
I've never purchased alcohol, so I think in my mind, I thought it was going to be something really epic. And I don't feel that this is...
No. Mm. No, I really don't think it was... I mean, worst case, it's like, even if it was $2 per beer,
mm-hmm.
it's not exorbitant, right?
So the other thing that I understood from it, Simon, is that now beer companies can be more competitive, but I didn't fully understand that point.
I honestly don't. I feel like it's a sort of thing where, like,
Is it like, here's the minimum price, and if you want to charge people like $36 for a 24-pack of beer, that's your choice.
Yeah.
But somebody else can charge 24?
So the way they had positioned kind of this buck a beer thing is that by setting the minimum price to be, let's say $2. Okay. I don't think it was $2, but let's say it's $2.
Right.
Then the price difference between a buck a beer and a 2-buck beer, that dollar goes straight into the pockets of big beer companies. Mm-hmm. And so by augmenting the price, you just give beer companies an extra buck per beer. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it was the previous government's decision to, increase profits of beer companies or something.
And wasn't there also, aligned with this policy that there would be certain distances. There's a distance mandate between liquor stores.
I'm not sure about the distance mandate, but in Ontario you have, I don't think it's still 100% the case, but it's a monopoly, so it's government. Okay. You need to buy alcohol in government businesses, I guess.
Okay.
So from the government.
So you couldn't purchase it. I don't know if I understand what that means, Simon. So let's say here you have like Sobeys or Save-On Foods.
Yeah.
Like a grocery chain.
Yes.
And right beside the grocery chain, they have their liquor store.
Yeah. So liquor store is the word I was looking for. So
is that the government owned?
Yes. Yeah. Those are owned by the government.
So what if it's like a I don't know if it's private, but let's say it's in a strip mall.
Yeah.
And you've got like your Starbucks and you've got your, iCenter and you've got the bakery and all of that. And then there's this wine and spirits store.
So I don't know how it is in Alberta, but here, like, corner stores aren't allowed to sell alcohol.
Okay. Yeah. So we do have that. Yeah. But you know what? At one point, I was working with the School of Public Health at the University of Alberta. And one of my things to look at was strategies for the community to reduce alcohol use. Well, actually, it's alcohol misuse. It's not use. It's the misuse of alcohol. And one of the strategies, and this was based on evidence. So we took review level evidence. So whether it was a systematic review or a scoping review, we took that evidence and then we synthesized it into a strategy kit for the community. So a community health worker would take a look at this kit and let's say they wanted to implement things with various organizations in their city or their community to reduce alcohol misuse. These would be like the top few things that you could do. One of the things was that you did need to space out the distance between liquor stores. That's one thing. And from what I understand from the media, Doug Ford had said he's going to, he's leaving the, he said that the public is mature enough to be able to handle or to make appropriate decisions in the purchase of alcohol, and therefore alcohol can be sold in many more locations than they're already being sold.
Yeah. And that's, as I understand it, what he said. And this idea of the public being mature enough to make responsible decisions for themselves, I think is it's really interesting because as voters, you'd think, I'm responsible enough. I can make my own decisions.
Yes.
But when you look at, and it's true mostly, I guess.
Yes.
But when you look at like society and the long-term effects of that choice, then you see that, and I've got the stats, I'll need to line them up. But with every dollar increase or a percentage increase of alcohol costs, you have these crazy reductions in
absolutely harm and that was one of the strategies was to increase the price. And we see that with tobacco.
Yeah.
We see with the increase in tobacco that the point that they're increasing the price is to reduce misuse. So there is evidence suggesting that if you increase the price, that it will decrease the likelihood of misuse because it just will not be affordable.
So in this, yeah, like in the States, there was this study by David Rudman, and all of the studies that were that I found, we're all gonna put them on the website.
Yeah.
So this was a review on alcohol price research, so kind mm-hmm. of a meta-analysis.
Yeah.
And he found that in the States, a 10% price increase cuts the death rate
mm-hmm.
by 9 to 25%.
Is that related to motor vehicle collisions?
It's just kind
of, or is it
liver
just overall
abuse? Mm-hmm. Just everything.
My understanding is that it does play a significant role in the motor vehicle component.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm sure there are examples specifically for vehicle accidents, but you've got an increase in price, a cut in death. It just seems like, yeah, you can have your beer a bit cheaper, but the societal costs are unreal.
And the other thing too, Simon, going back to this concept that Doug Ford is saying, I think we're mature individuals and we can make appropriate decisions. That's not grounded in the knowledge of how a substance use disorder
mm-hmm.
Develops and how it functions. It's not about maturity. It's about an illness.
And I think it's important when we talk about alcohol not to, because a lot of people do drink, that it's not just people who have substance misuse.
That's right. That's right. Substance misuse or a substance use disorder. But I mean, that's part of it. I mean, I think, yes, there is mature and responsible use. And I agree with you that that's perhaps the majority of individuals. But mm-hmm. it's not considering those most vulnerable in our community.
That's true.
And isn't there a quote? I don't recall who it's by, but the quote is you can make a you can have a good picture of a community or of a city or of a place or a government based on how they treat their most vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Was that Gandhi? Was it Gandhi who said that?
Maybe.
Probably. You heard it here first. That's evidence-based.
Probably.
Quote
it probably is. It's just there's so much knowledge in here, Simon. I need to organize it better.
I'll just quickly go over a couple stats that I found for these are provincial stats.
Okay.
So in Saskatchewan, an 8.4% reduction in consumption was observed for every 10% increase in minimum price.
Wow.
So you increase by 10%, the consumption reduces by 8.4.
Mm-hmm.
And senior police officers, this isn't sort of stats-based, it's more observations, but senior police reported that alcohol-related crimes were halved.
Wouldn't this be based on their database?
Yeah.
Was it not clear in the article?
It wasn't clear in the article. Okay. In BC, so there was something that happened, I think, in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
Again, 10% increase in minimum price was associated with a 9% reduction in acute alcohol-related hospital admissions from injuries and poisoning.
So that's misuse right there, right? That's alcohol misuse, yeah.
Right, that's true. I guess I don't identify misuse as alcohol poisoning, but it is.
It is, yeah.
It is, yeah. It is. There was also a similar but delayed reduction in admissions for alcohol-related diseases.
Okay.
And so this is from 2002 to 2009. There was that 10% increase in average minimum price was associated with a 32% percent reduction in alcohol attributable deaths.
So again, it's still misuse.
Yeah. And significant reductions in chronic and total alcohol attributable deaths were detected between 2 and 3 years after minimum price increases. And this is where you go, three years, that takes a while.
Well, and it usually does take time to see the impact, right? Of any type of, because this type of price change would be considered an intervention, right? It's a price intervention. So to see the impact, it does need to be longitudinal. And that's pretty good that you're seeing the impact after 2 to 3 years.
Is that a good time?
That's pretty good, yes.
Huh.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
And do you think that because politicians kind of focus on four-year cycles, mm-hmm. there's a mismatch between what Absolutely. They'll push mm-hmm. yeah, and what the actual effects of their policies
and,
are?
And really we see that very often again in my field of the addiction mental health, because often the positive impact of an intervention is much longer than a four-year time frame. So part of it is the impact will be seen in someone else's time being elected. Mm-hmm.
Right.
The impact, they won't necessarily attribute this change to the person who actually said, let's make this change. Let's incorporate this intervention. Yeah.
Hmm. And while reading, so I believe in evidence-based policy, so mm-hmm. kind of making choices in government based on evidence. Mm-hmm. I think you do as well.
I do. But there's a challenge there, Simon, with the evidence base. So what if it's something that's relatively new? And we do have some evidence. Let's say, I can't think of a specific example, but let's say I ran a randomized controlled trial for an intervention. Yeah. And I found that there was a significant change in risk of developing a substance use disorder. And this mm-hmm. was the only research that was available. Yeah. This is the only evidence at the point at this point in time. Mm-hmm. I would then develop a policy based on that. Is that really an evidence-based policy? I mean, kind of. But really, when we're looking for an evidence base to inform a policy, we're looking for replication.
Yeah.
So what components have been replicated to the point where you need to say something, Simon. I think it's like this idea of replication, right?
Well, it's so funny because as scientists, I hear you speaking, and I'm like, yes, of course, that makes sense because I understand how science works.
Yeah.
But I could also see how someone who isn't as familiar with the scientific process would mm-hmm. say, oh, I got this article right here.
Absolutely. And that happens all the time.
Yeah. And then if it doesn't pan out, they're like, what is this garbage science?
But even Simon, never again. Do you remember when we were at that science policy conference? And mm-hmm. I don't think we attended the session at the same time because I was interested in the kind of rare disease component. And I think you were more interested in like innovation and policy type stuff that you mm-hmm. had attended a different session. But what if it's a rare condition?
Yeah.
And developing the evidence base is challenging because A, you don't have mm-hmm. very many people to test a certain, I guess, intervention on. It's costly. And then that falls into that idea of replication. And we need change for this particular group of individuals. Yeah. So I can see how a policy would be implemented on that basis. But I think it's if policy is then implemented, we're looking for a continued evidence base to then modify the policy.
Yeah, that
in an ideal world, Simon, we would have mm-hmm. multiple studies over decades.
Yeah.
With various cultures, with various demographics, in which we would then be able to develop a policy.
Yeah, and it's with the amount of knowledge that's being produced too. It's so hard to keep up. And also that most research is done with white university students.
Yes.
So good point for the multicultural aspect of that.
Yeah. And then it's this idea of replication. So often much of my work cannot be done with a randomized controlled trial design. And we know that the randomized controlled trial is considered the quote unquote gold standard. But let's say in my work, when I'm taking youth who are actively suicidal, I mm-hmm. can't randomly allocate them to control an experimental group and then just watch.
Yeah.
You just can't do that. Especially with with something like suicidal ideation, it's elusive even to the most highly skilled professional. So this idea of replication, I was talking to a colleague, and this feeds into our evidence-based policy, is how do we develop an evidence base? On the one hand, we could work toward a solution-focused project, which is like actually implement an intervention in the community mm-hmm. under real-world settings.
How do you get ethical approval for that?
To do an in-community intervention?
Yeah.
A lot of it requires parental consent. So for each stage, so if the parents consent to this particular intervention, then they can have it. If they don't consent, then they don't have it. So you get a lot of youth that fall through the cracks that way. But, you know, that's that solution-focused idea is like, let's implement it in the real world. And then because it's so challenging to get a funding body to then fund you for replication. So let's say somebody ran a randomized control trial. And I say, I'm going to run the same trial to see if I can replicate it. Apparently, it's really hard to get funding for that because it's nothing new.
Yeah, yeah.
So to get around that, you can do this effectiveness trial. So that's running it within the community, seeing if it worked under real world conditions, and then saying, okay, now I want to hone in and see what factors actually supported the changes that I see within this real world experiment. And then there you would do the randomized control trial. What are your thoughts on that, Simon?
I think it's, as scientists, I'm trying to think of it, because now as people who might be listening to this know, Duvian Science is on community radio.
That's right. So
hopefully you're listening to this on the radio. I think that a lot of what we talk about makes sense if you understand the context of science.
I agree.
And so what you're describing would require some pretty sophisticated stats to take out these little effect sizes and all these things. And so if you want to present, like if ultimately what it is that you're trying to do is impact policy, all those subtleties and everything is going to get lost in the, I guess, the like communication of your results. And so
I think it's because they want the so what, or like, what do I do now concept.
Exactly.
And that's where our role is, you know, taking it from, and I think that's why researchers have to be, have to play a significant role in policy, because we do know all those intricate details.
Yeah.
Right. We know those intricate details, but that's what feeds into this, you know, kind of lay summary type policy. That has that usability.
Yeah.
I think that goes into our, you know, we need that RV. We need that researcher's RV, and we'll just go around and say, this is our research, and, you know, this is how it can impact policy.
Yeah, it would be so much fun to have the DYES RV.
We're having it. We're saving up. I think we should have a fund. We should open a fund for people to donate to this cause.
Exactly. Or if you're an RV rental person.
Yes, absolutely.
And you just want to sponsor. We were looking for sponsors.
Absolutely.
Maybe that'll be our first sponsor.
RV companies, you know where we are. And you know what else too, Simon?
Tweet us at DYES.
_podcast.
If you have an RV that you want to lend us for a few weeks.
So the other thing too, Simon, is when we look at knowledge translation or even the policy type thing, is often these are listed on Google. So as I asked you, like I posed that question to you, I'm like, Simon, when you want to find something out, or you want to you have a question, where do you go? And you're like, to the internet. One of the challenges is, how do we critically appraise or assess the information that's listed on websites that is sharing knowledge?
Are there any tools or frameworks?
Have you heard of the crap test? It's like the best named tool when I saw it. So it's actually through a library guide. I'll post it on Twitter for everyone to have. I did post it on my personal Twitter handle, but I will post it under DYES_podcast. So it's the crap test. It was developed by Molly Bistrom, and it's to help you see if a website is a credible and valid source.
Okay.
So CRAP stands for currency. So how recent is the information? How recently was the website updated? And I think we talked about that with our superstar BBC science journalist, Matt McGraw. And then also,
I hope he listens to these.
He should. And also under currency is the information current enough to your topic? So let's say you're an expert in the topic. Do you find that the information is you know, current?
Yeah.
The R in CRAP stands for reliability. So what kind of information is included in the resource? And is the resource an opinion? So is this based on opinion or is it based on, you know, as we're talking, an evidence base? So are there references there for resources?
How do you distinguish informed opinion? Like if you give your opinion on something, I would trust you because I know that, well, on something related to your field of expertise, I would trust you because you're an expert. You get like the general context.
But I think also in being an expert, you know the main players or the leaders in the area. So I would be able to tell you, you know, if I'm talking to you about mixed methodology, I'd be able to tell you, well, if you know, Creswell says, you know, this and this, or Plano Clark says this or this, you know, you would be able to, within the context, maybe you don't have citations, formal citations, but you would say like, here's this context and here are these references that support what I'm saying.
Okay.
If that makes sense. So that's actually under reliability. Like, does this creator provide references or sources for the data?
Okay.
Or for what you're actually saying? The A in CRAP is who is the creator or author? What are their credentials? And can you find any information about the author's background?
Right.
And then who published this? Are they reputable? What's the publisher's interest? So it's kind of like when we read manuscripts about new pharma, you know, techniques, but it's like funded by pharma. And are there advertisements on the website? And if they're clearly marked?
Okay.
The P, so that's the final component of the CRAP test, is purpose or point of view. So again, it goes back to, is this fact or opinion? Is there a list of sources? Is there a citation for references? Is it biased? Does it seem like the author is trying to push one side or an agenda? Or do they present, like, is it balanced? Do they present both sides? And are they trying to sell you something? And if they are trying to sell you something, is it transparent? Like, I'm trying to sell you something.
Right.
So I will post this, but I think this could be handy for individuals to try and assess the credibility or validity of a website source.
I wish I had unlimited time and technical ability because something that I'd love to do would be like Chrome. Yeah, like a Chrome plugin where it would automatically filter out those things and kind of give some sort of a weighted score.
So what's interesting is...
Does that exist?
Yes. So actually I'm working... Well, not I don't think in that larger context, but in some work that I'm doing with Dr. Francois Balduc here at the University of Alberta. So it's looking at neurodevelopmental disorders and resources for parents, guardians, or physicians related to that. We're creating a bot that would then provide a credibility score.
Cool.
For the websites that or resources that would be provided to these people.
Is that under the NeuroDevNet or Kids Brain Health Network?
Yes, it is.
It is. My colleague is in charge of their knowledge mobilization initiative.
Wow, awesome. Cool. I was just brought on to that project as an evaluation advisor.
Very cool.
Yeah, so I mean things are coming through. Yeah.
So quick questions before we wrap this up, Dina. A couple of quick questions that I don't know if there are even answers to these questions. So let's see what you'll have to say. Who should be responsible for, who should be held accountable for policies that may be popular, but ultimately we know because of evidence and because of research lead to harms, lead to deaths? Is it politicians, policymakers? Like, is there somebody that should be... It should seems, say hold
it,
up.
Yeah, it seems like it would be the team. Like in my mind, with, let's say, Doug Ford and this bucket beer, was mm-hmm. there a team, an advisory team, that had said to him, yeah. here's the evidence about increasing prices of alcohol and reducing harms associated with alcohol misuse?
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's the case.
I don't know. Are there class action lawsuits against governments for harmful policies?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I'd be really upset. Like, if, and to go back to the sex ed curriculum, like if I had a child who was bullied to suicide because that yeah. happens.
Yes.
I would be so upset. And like, where do you channel that rage and to make sure that that doesn't happen to anybody else?
I mean, I think that there have even been, so if we think of class action suits, there have been mm-hmm. in the case of medications, right, that had caused harms to large, like masses of people.
Right.
And there's a class action suit for that. But that was for a pharmaceutical company and not yeah. for government. Can you think of a class action against government?
I can't because I guess, and that goes to the second question, like, it's so difficult to pinpoint that you know, to say, oh, beer is now a dollar. It's not because beer's a dollar that person got drunk and ran over a group of people. It's because all of these other factors.
Well, there is a class action suit.
Okay.
And this is against the federal government. Like, I can't even believe that we didn't even, like, slipped our mind. This is, like, the most important class okay. action lawsuit for the way the RCMP handled the investigations of Indigenous women that were murdered or missing.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So that's a class action lawsuit.
I don't know enough about that to speak on it, but yeah.
Yeah. There's another one here. I'm not too familiar with it, but it's about a privacy breach of close to 600,000 students related to their student loan privacy information.
Okay.
So there are, but how would you tie that? I mean, the government would be able to say that there were all these other factors that contributed. Exactly. You exactly. wouldn't be able to say that this specifically, like, it's different here than, let's say, this is a lawsuit because of a privacy yeah. breach versus somebody died by suicide. There's so many factors that are involved.
Yeah.
And yes, the sex ed curriculum could have played a part in it. But mm-hmm. to say that that was the only thing that contributed, that's impossible to determine.
Yeah, it's too bad. It is. Accountability, eh? Like, it's...
But I agree with yeah. you. Who should be accountable? Is it the politician who then comes out and says, well, this is what I stand for? Like, in my opinion, yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't... Maybe some listeners have opinions on this.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see. What are your thoughts on evidence and policy? Should policy guide the search for evidence, or should evidence be the basis for policy development? Tweet us at @DYES_podcast. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Check us out on iTunes. Make sure to leave us a nice review. On our next episode, Green Rush or Green Goblin, the varying potencies of cannabis legalization.